The Portrait of a Lady, Volume 1. Link 2H Pref. Preface. The Portrait of a Lady was, like Roderick Hudson, begun in Florence, during 3 months spent there in the spring of 1879. Like Roderick and like the American, it had been designed for publication in the Atlantic Monthly, where it began to appear in 1880. It differed from its two predecessors, however, in finding a course also open to it, from month to month, in Macmillan's magazine, which was to be for me one of the last occasions of simultaneous serialization in the two countries that the changing conditions of literary intercourse between England and the United States had up to then left unaltered. It is a long novel, and I was long in writing it. I remember being again much occupied with it, the following year, during a stay of several weeks made in Venice. I had rooms on Riva Schiavoni, at the top of a house near the passage leading off to San Zaccaria. The waterside life, the wondrous lagoon spread before me, and the ceaseless human chatter of Venice came in at my windows, to which I seemed to myself to have been constantly driven, in the fruitless fidget of composition, as if to see whether, out in the blue channel, the ship of some right suggestion, of some better phrase, of the next happy twist of my subject, the next true touch for my canvas, mightn't come into sight. But I recall vividly enough that the response most elicited, in general, to these restless appeals was the rather grim admonition that romantic and historic sites, such as the land of Italy abounds in, offer the artist a questionable aid to concentration when they themselves are not to be the subject of it. They are too rich in their own life and too charged with their own meanings merely to help him out with a lame phrase. They draw him away from his small question to their own greater ones, so that, after a little, he feels, while thus yearning toward them in his difficulty, as if he were asking an army of glorious veterans to help him to arrest a peddler who has given him the wrong change. There are pages of the book which, in the reading over, have seemed to make me see again the bristling curve of the wide Riva, the large color spots of the balconied houses and the repeated undulation of the little hunchback bridges, marked by the rise and drop again, with the wave, of foreshortened clicking pedestrians. The Venetian footfall and the Venetian cry, all talk there, wherever uttered, having the pitch of a call across the water, come in once more at the window, renewing one's old impression of the delighted senses and the divided, frustrated mind. How can places that speak in general so to the imagination not give it, at the moment, the particular thing it wants? I recollect again and again, in beautiful places, dropping into that wonderment. The real truth is, I think, that they express, under this appeal, only too much, more than, in the given case, one has use for, so that one finds oneself working less congruously, after all, so far as the surrounding picture is concerned, than in presence of the moderate and the neutral, to which we may lend something of the light of our vision. Such a place as Venice is too proud for such charities. Venice doesn't borrow, she but all magnificently gives. We profit by that enormously, but to do so we must either be quite off duty or be on it in her service alone. Such, and so rueful, are these reminiscences, though on the whole, no doubt, one's book, and one's literary effort at large, were to be the better for them. Strangely fertilizing, in the long run, does a wasted effort of attention often prove. It all depends on how the attention has been cheated, has been squandered. There are high-handed insolent frauds, and there are insidious sneaking ones. And there is, I fear, even on the most designing artist's part, always witless enough good faith, always anxious enough desire, to fail to guard him against their deceits. Trying to recover here, for recognition, the germ of my idea, I see that it must have consisted not at all in any conceit of a plot, nefarious name, in any flash, upon the fancy, of a set of relations, or in any one of those situations that, by a logic of their own, immediately fall, for the fabulist, into movement, into a march or a rush, a patter of quick steps, but altogether in the sense of a single character, the character and aspect of a particular engaging young woman, to which all the usual elements of a subject, certainly of a setting, were to need to be superadded. Quite as interesting as the young woman herself at her best, do I find, I must again repeat, this projection of memory upon the whole matter of the growth, in one's imagination, of some such apology for a motive. These are the fascinations of the fabulous art, these lurking forces of expansion, these necessities of upspringing in the seed, these beautiful determinations, on the part of the idea entertained, to grow as tall as possible, to push into the light and the air and thickly flower there, and, quite as much, these fine possibilities of recovering, from some good standpoint on the ground gained, the intimate history of the business, of retracing and reconstructing its steps and stages. I have always fondly remembered a remark that I heard fall years ago from the lips of Ivan Turgenev in regard to his own experience of the usual origin of the fictive picture. It began for him almost always with the vision of some person or persons, who hovered before him, soliciting him, as the active or passive figure, interesting him and appealing to him just as they were and by what they were. He saw them, in that fashion, as disponibles, saw them subject to the chances, the complications of existence, and saw them vividly, but then had to find for them the right relations, those that would most bring them out, to imagine, to invent and select and piece together the situations most useful and favorable to the sense of the creatures themselves, the complications they would be most likely to produce and to feel. "To arrive at these things is to arrive at my story," he said, "and that's the way I look for it. The result is that I'm often accused of not having story enough. I seem to myself to have as much as I need, to show my people, to exhibit their relations with each other, for that is all my measure. If I watch them long enough I see them come together, I see them placed, I see them engaged in this or that act and in this or that difficulty. How they look and move and speak and behave, always in the setting I have found for them, is my account of them, of which I dare say, alas, que cela manque souvent d'architecture. But I would rather, I think, have too little architecture than too much, when there's danger of its interfering with my measure of the truth. The French of course like more of it than I give, having by their own genius such a hand for it, and indeed one must give all one can. As for the origin of one's wind-blown germs themselves, who shall say, as you ask, where they come from? We have to go too far back, too far behind, to say. Isn't it all we can say that they come from every quarter of heaven, that they are there at almost any turn of the road? They accumulate, and we are always picking them over, selecting among them. They are the breath of life, by which I mean that life, in its own way, breathes them upon us. They are so, in a manner prescribed and imposed, floated into our minds by the current of life. That reduces to imbecility the vain critic's quarrel, so often, with one subject, when he hasn't the wit to accept it. Will he point out then which other it should properly have been? His office being, essentially to point out. Il en serait bien embarrassé. Ah, when he points out what I've done or failed to do with it, that's another matter, there he's on his ground. I give him up my architecture, my distinguished friend concluded, as much as he will. So this beautiful genius, and I recall with comfort the gratitude I drew from his reference to the intensity of suggestion that may reside in the stray figure, the unattached character, the image and disponibleite. It gave me higher warrant than I seemed then to have met for just that blessed habit of one's own imagination, the trick of investing some conceived or encountered individual, some brace or group of individuals, with the germinal property and authority. I was myself so much more antecedently conscious of my figures than of their setting, a too preliminary, a preferential interest in which struck me as in general such a putting of the cart before the horse. I might envy, though I couldn't emulate, the imaginative writer so constituted as to see his fable first and to make out its agents afterwards. I could think so little of any fable that didn't need its agents positively to launch it. I could think so little of any situation that didn't depend for its interest on the nature of the persons situated, and thereby on their way of taking it. There are methods of so-called presentation, I believe among novelists who have appeared to flourish, that offer the situation as indifferent to that support, but I have not lost the sense of the value for me, at the time, of the admirable Russian's testimony to my not needing, all superstitiously, to try and perform any such gymnastic. Other echoes from the same source linger with me, I confess, as unfadingly, if it be not all indeed one much embracing echo. It was impossible after that not to read, for one's uses, high lucidity into the tormented and disfigured and bemuddled question of the objective value, and even quite into that of the critical appreciation, of subject in the novel. One had had from an early time, for that matter, the instinct of the right estimate of such values and of its reducing to the inane the dull dispute over the immoral subject and the moral. Recognizing so promptly the one measure of the worth of a given subject, the question about it that, rightly answered, disposes of all others, is it valid, in a word, is it genuine, is it sincere, the result of some direct impression or perception of life? I had found small edification, mostly, in a critical pretension that had neglected from the first all delimitation of ground and all definition of terms. The air of my earlier time shows, to memory, as darkened, all round, with that vanity, unless the difference today be just in one's own final impatience, the lapse of one's attention. There is, I think, no more nutritive or suggestive truth in this connection than that of the perfect dependence of the moral sense of a work of art on the amount of felt life concerned in producing it. The question comes back thus, obviously, to the kind and the degree of the artist's prime sensibility, which is the soil out of which his subject springs. The quality and capacity of that soil, its ability to grow with due freshness and straightness any vision of life, represents, strongly or weakly, the projected morality. That element is but another name for the more or less close connection of the subject with some mark made on the intelligence, with some sincere experience. By which, at the same time, of course, one is far from contending that this enveloping air of the artist's humanity, which gives the last touch to the worth of the work, is not a widely and wondrously varying element, being on one occasion a rich and magnificent medium and on another a comparatively poor and ungenerous one. Here we get exactly the high price of the novel as a literary form, its power not only, while preserving that form with closeness, to range through all the differences of the individual relation to its general subject matter, all the varieties of outlook on life, of disposition to reflect and project, created by conditions that are never the same from man to man, or, so far as that goes, from man to woman, but positively to appear more true to its character in proportion as it strains, or tends to burst, with a latent extravagance, its mold. The House of Fiction has in short not one window, but a million, a number of possible windows not to be reckoned, rather, every one of which has been pierced, or is still pierceable, in its vast front, by the need of the individual vision and by the pressure of the individual will. These apertures, of dissimilar shape and size, hang so, all together, over the human scene that we might have expected of them a greater sameness of report than we find. They are but windows at the best, mere holes in a dead wall, disconnected, perched aloft, they are not hinged doors opening straight upon life. But they have this mark of their own that at each of them stands a figure with a pair of eyes, or at least with a field glass, which forms, again and again, for observation, a unique instrument, ensuring to the person making use of it an impression distinct from every other. He and his neighbors are watching the same show, but one seeing more where the other sees less, one seeing black where the other sees white, one seeing big where the other sees small, one seeing coarse where the other sees fine. And so on, there is fortunately no saying on what, for the particular pair of eyes, the window may not open, fortunately by reason, precisely, of this incalculability of range. The spreading field, the human scene, is the choice of subject, the pierced aperture, either broad or balconied or slit-like and low-browed, is the literary form, but they are, singly or together, as nothing without the posted presence of the watcher, without, in other words, the consciousness of the artist. Tell me what the artist is, and I will tell you of what he has been conscious. Thereby I shall express to you at once his boundless freedom and his moral reference. All this is a long way round, however, for my word about my dim first move toward the portrait, which was exactly my grasp of a single character, an acquisition I had made, moreover, after a fashion not here to be retraced. Enough that I was, as seemed to me, in complete possession of it, that I had been so for a long time, that this had made it familiar and yet had not blurred its charm, and that, all urgently, all tormentingly, I saw it in motion and, so to speak, in transit. This amounts to saying that I saw it as bent upon its fate, some fate or other, which, among the possibilities, being precisely the question. Thus I had my vivid individual, vivid, so strangely, in spite of being still at large, not confined by the conditions, not engaged in the tangle, to which we look for much of the impress that constitutes an identity. If the apparition was still all to be placed, how came it to be vivid? Since we puzzle such quantities out, mostly, just by the business of placing them. One could answer such a question beautifully, doubtless, if one could do so subtle, if not so monstrous, a thing as to write the history of the growth of one's imagination. One would describe then what, at a given time, had extraordinarily happened to it, and one would so, for instance, be in a position to tell, with an approach to clearness, how, under favor of occasion, it had been able to take over straight from life, such and such a constituted, animated figure or form. The figure has to that extent, as you see, been placed, placed in the imagination that detains it, preserves, protects, enjoys it, conscious of its presence in the dusky, crowded, heterogeneous back shop of the mind very much as a wary dealer in precious odds and ends, competent to make an advance on rare objects confided to him, is conscious of the rare little piece left in deposit by the reduced, mysterious lady of title or the speculative amateur, and which is already there to disclose its merit afresh as soon as a key shall have clicked in a cupboard door. That may he, I recognize, a somewhat superfine analogy for the particular value I here speak of. The image of the young feminine nature that I had had for so considerable a time all curiously at my disposal, but it appears to fond memory quite to fit the fact, with the recall, in addition, of my pious desire but to place my treasure right. I quite remind myself thus of the dealer resigned not to realize, resigned to keeping the precious object locked up indefinitely rather than commit it, at no matter what price, to vulgar hands. For there are dealers in these forms and figures and treasures capable of that refinement. The point is, however, that this single small cornerstone, the conception of a certain young woman affronting her destiny, had begun with being all my outfit for the large building of the portrait of a lady. It came to be a square and spacious house, or has at least seemed so to me in this going over it again, but, such as it is, it had to be put up round my young woman while she stood there in perfect isolation. That is to me, artistically speaking, the circumstance of interest, for I have lost myself once more, I confess, in the curiosity of analyzing the structure. By what process of logical accretion was this slight personality, the mere slim shade of an intelligent but presumptuous girl, to find itself endowed with the high attributes of a subject? And indeed by what thinness, at the best, would such a subject not be vitiated? Millions of presumptuous girls, intelligent or not intelligent, daily affront their destiny, and what is it open to their destiny to be, at the most, that we should make an ado about it? The novel is of its very nature an ado about something, and the larger the form it takes the greater of course the ado. Therefore, consciously, that was what one was in for positively organizing an ado about Isabel Archer. One looked it well in the face, I seem to remember, this extravagance, and with the effect precisely of recognizing the charm of the problem. Challenge any such problem with any intelligence, and you immediately see how full it is of substance, the wonder being, all the while, as we look at the world, how absolutely, how inordinately, the Isabel Archers, and even much smaller female fry, insist on mattering. George Eliot has admirably noted it, in these frail vessels is borne onward through the ages the treasure of human affection. In Romeo and Juliet, Juliet has to be important, just as, in Adam Bede and the Mill on the Floss and Middlemarch and Daniel Deronda, Hetty Sorrel and Maggie Tulliver and Rosamund Vincy and Gwendolyn Harleth have to be, with that much of firm ground, that much of bracing air, at the disposal all the while of their feet and their lungs. They are typical, nonetheless, of a class difficult, in the individual case, to make a center of interest, so difficult in fact that many an expert painter, as for instance Dickens and Walter Scott, as for instance even, in the main, so subtle a hand as that of R.L. Stevenson, has preferred to leave the task unattempted. There are in fact writers as to whom we make out that their refuge from this is to assume it to be not worth their attempting, by which pusillanimity in truth their honor is scantly saved. It is never an attestation of a value, or even of our imperfect sense of one, it is never a tribute to any truth at all, that we shall represent that value badly. It never makes up, artistically, for an artist's stimp feeling about a thing that he shall do the thing as ill as possible. There are better ways than that, the best of all of which is to begin with less stupidity. It may be answered meanwhile, in regard to Shakespeare's and to George Eliot's testimony, that their concession to the importance of their Juliets and Cleopatras and Portias, even with Portia as the very type and model of the young person intelligent and presumptuous, and to that of their Hetties and Maggies and Rosamunds and Gwendolyns, suffers the abatement that these slimnesses are, when figuring as the main props of the theme, never suffered to be sole ministers of its appeal, but have their inadequacy eked out with comic relief and underplots, as the playwrights say, when not with murders and battles and the great mutations of the world. If they are shown as mattering as much as they could possibly pretend to, the proof of it is in 100 other persons, made of much stouter stuff, and each involved moreover in 100 relations which matter to them concomitantly with that one. Cleopatra matters, beyond bounds, to Antony, but his colleagues, his antagonists, the state of Rome and the impending battle also prodigiously matter. Portia matters to Antonio, and to Shylock, and to the Prince of Morocco, to the 50 aspiring princes. But for these gentry there are other lively concerns, for Antonio, notably, there are Shylock and Bassanio and his lost ventures and the extremity of his predicament. This extremity indeed, by the same token, matters to Portia, though its doing so becomes of interest all by the fact that Portia matters to us. That she does so, at any rate, and that almost everything comes round to it again, supports my contention as to this fine example of the value recognized in the mere young thing. I say mere young thing because I guess that even Shakespeare, preoccupied mainly though he may have been with the passions of princes, would scarce have pretended to found the best of his appeal for her on her high social position. It is an example exactly of the deep difficulty braved, the difficulty of making George Eliot's frail vessel, if not the all-in-all for our attention, at least the clearest of the call. Now to see deep difficulty braved is at any time, for the really addicted artist, to feel almost even as a pang the beautiful incentive, and to feel it verily in such sort as to wish the danger intensified. The difficulty most worth tackling can only be for him, in these conditions, the greatest the case permits of. So I remember feeling here, in presence, always, that is, of the particular uncertainty of my ground, that there would be one way better than another, oh, ever so much better than any other, of making it fight out its battle. The frail vessel, that charged with George Eliot's treasure, and thereby of such importance to those who curiously approach it, has likewise possibilities of importance to itself, possibilities which permit of treatment and in fact peculiarly require it from the moment they are considered at all. There is always the escape from any close account of the weak agent of such spells by using as a bridge for evasion, for retreat and flight, the view of her relation to those surrounding her. Make it predominantly a view of their relation and the trick is played, you give the general sense of her effect, and you give it, so far as the raising on it of a superstructure goes, with the maximum of ease. Well, I recall perfectly how little, in my now quite established connection, the maximum of ease appealed to me, and how I seemed to get rid of it by an honest transposition of the weights in the two scales. Place the center of the subject in the young woman's own consciousness, I said to myself, and you get as interesting and as beautiful a difficulty as you could wish. Stick to that for the center, put the heaviest weight into that scale, which will be so largely the scale of her relation to herself. Make her only interested enough, at the same time, in the things that are not herself, and this relation needn't fear to be too limited. Place meanwhile in the other scale the lighter weight, which is usually the one that tips the balance of interest, press least hard, in short, on the consciousness of your heroine's satellites, especially the male, make it an interest contributive only to the greater one. See, at all events, what can be done in this way? What better field could there be for a due ingenuity? The girl hovers, inextinguishable, as a charming creature, and the job will be to translate her into the highest terms of that formula, and as nearly as possible moreover into all of them. To depend upon her and her little concerns wholly to see you through will necessitate, remember, your really doing her. So far I reasoned, and it took nothing less than that technical rigor, I now easily see, to inspire me with the right confidence for erecting on such a plot of ground the neat and careful and proportioned pile of bricks that arches over it and that was thus to form, constructionally speaking, a literary monument. Such is the aspect that today the portrait wears for me, a structure reared with an architectural competence, as Turgenev would have said, that makes it, to the author's own sense, the most proportioned of his productions after The Ambassadors, which was to follow it so many years later and which has, no doubt, a superior roundness. On one thing I was determined, that, though I should clearly have to pile brick upon brick for the creation of an interest, I would leave no pretext for saying that anything is out of line, scale or perspective. I would build large, in fine embossed vaults and painted arches, as who should say, and yet never let it appear that the checkered pavement, the ground under the reader's feet, fails to stretch at every point to the base of the walls. That precautionary spirit, on reperusal of the book, is the old note that most touches me, it testifies so, for my own ear, to the anxiety of my provision for the reader's amusement. I felt, in view of the possible limitations of my subject, that no such provision could be excessive, and the development of the latter was simply the general form of that earnest quest. And I find indeed that this is the only account I can give myself of the evolution of the fable. It is all under the head thus named that I conceive the needful accretion as having taken place, the right complications as having started. It was naturally of the essence that the young woman should be herself complex, that was rudimentary, or was at any rate the light in which Isabel Archer had originally dawned. It went, however, but a certain way, and other lights, contending, conflicting lights, and of as many different colors, if possible, as the rockets, the Roman candles and Catherine wheels of a pyrotechnic display, would be employable to attest that she was. I had, no doubt, a groping instinct for the right complications, since I am quite unable to track the footsteps of those that constitute, as the case stands, the general situation exhibited. They are there, for what they are worth, and as numerous as might be, but my memory, I confess, is a blank as to how and whence they came. I seem to myself to have waked up one morning in possession of them, of Ralph Touchett and his parents, of Madame Merle, of Gilbert Osmond and his daughter and his sister, of Lord Warburton, Caspar Goodwood, and Miss Stackpole, the definite array of contributions to Isabel Archer's history. I recognized them, I knew them, they were the numbered pieces of my puzzle, the concrete terms of my plot. It was as if they had simply, by an impulse of their own, floated into my ken, and all in response to my primary question, well, what will she do? Their answer seemed to be that if I would trust them they would show me, on which, with an urgent appeal to them to make it at least as interesting as they could, I trusted them. They were like the group of attendants and entertainers who come down by train when people in the country give a party, they represented the contract for carrying the party on. That was an excellent relation with them, a possible one even with so broken a reed, from her slightness of cohesion, as Henrietta Stackpole. It is a familiar truth to the novelist, at the strenuous hour, that, as certain elements in any work are of the essence, so others are only of the form, that is this or that character, this or that disposition of the material, belongs to the subject directly, so to speak, so this or that other belongs to it but indirectly, belongs intimately to the treatment. This is a truth, however, of which he rarely gets the benefit, since it could be assured to him, really, but by criticism based upon perception, criticism which is too little of this world. He must not think of benefits, moreover, I freely recognize, for that way dishonor lies, he has, that is, but one to think of, the benefit, whatever it may be, involved in his having cast a spell upon the simpler, the very simplest, forms of attention. This is all he is entitled to, he is entitled to nothing, he is bound to admit, that can come to him, from the reader, as a result on the latter's part of any act of reflection or discrimination. He may enjoy this finer tribute, that is another affair, but on condition only of taking it as a gratuity thrown in, a mere miraculous windfall, the fruit of a tree he may not pretend to have shaken. Against reflection, against discrimination, in his interest, all earth and air conspire, wherefore it is that, as I say, he must in many a case have schooled himself, from the first, to work but for a living wage. The living wage is the reader's grant of the least possible quantity of attention required for consciousness of a spell. The occasional charming tip is an act of his intelligence over and beyond this, a golden apple, for the writer's lap, straight from the wind-stirred tree. The artist may, of course, in wanton moods, dream of some paradise, for art, where the direct appeal to the intelligence might be legalized, for to such extravagances as these his yearning mind can scarce hope ever completely to close itself. The most he can do is to remember they are extravagances. All of which is perhaps but a gracefully devious way of saying that Henrietta Stackpole was a good example, in the portrait, of the truth to which I just adverted, as good an example as I could name were it not that Maria Gostrey, in The Ambassadors, then in The Bosom of Time, may be mentioned as a better. Each of these persons is but wheels to the coach, neither belongs to the body of that vehicle, or is for a moment accommodated with a seat inside. There the subject alone is ensconced, in the form of its hero and heroine, and of the privileged high officials, say, who ride with the king and queen. There are reasons why one would have liked this to be felt, as in general one would like almost anything to be felt, in one's work, that one has oneself contributively felt. We have seen, however, how idle is that pretension, which I should be sorry to make too much of. Maria Gostrey and Miss Stackpole then are cases, each, of the light facel, not of the true agent. They may run beside the coach for all they are worth, they may cling to it till they are out of breath, as poor Miss Stackpole also visibly does, but neither, all the while, so much as gets her foot on the step, neither ceases for a moment to tread the dusty road. Put it even that they are like the fishwives who helped to bring back to Paris from Versailles, on that most ominous day of the first half of the French Revolution, the carriage of the royal family. The only thing is that I may well be asked, I acknowledge, why then, in the present fiction, I have suffered Henrietta, of whom we have indubitably too much, so officiously, so strangely, so almost inexplicably, to pervade. I will presently say what I can for that anomaly, and in the most conciliatory fashion. A point I wish still more to make is that if my relation of confidence with the actors in my drama who were, unlike Miss Stackpole, true agents, was an excellent one to have arrived at, there still remained my relation with the reader, which was another affair altogether and as to which I felt no one to be trusted but myself. That solicitude was to be accordingly expressed in the artful patience with which, as I have said, I piled brick upon brick. The bricks, for the whole counting over, putting for bricks little touches and inventions and enhancements by the way, affect me in truth as well nigh innumerable and as ever so scrupulously fitted together and packed in. It is an effect of detail, of the minutest, though, if one were in this connection to say all, one would express the hope that the general, the ampler air of the modest monument still survives. I do at least seem to catch the key to a part of this abundance of small anxious, ingenious illustration as I recollect putting my finger, in my young woman's interest, on the most obvious of her predicates. What will she do? Why, the first thing she'll do will be to come to Europe, which in fact will form, and all inevitably, no small part of her principal adventure. Coming to Europe is even for the frail vessels, in this wonderful age, a mild adventure, but what is truer than that on one side, the side of their independence of flood and field, of the moving accident, of battle and murder and sudden death, her adventures are to be mild. Without her sense of them, her sense for them, as one may say, they are next to nothing at all, but isn't the beauty and the difficulty just in showing their mystic conversion by that sense, conversion into the stuff of drama or, even more delightful word still, of story? It was all as clear, My contention, as a silver bell. Two very good instances, I think, of this effect of conversion, two cases of the rare chemistry, are the pages in which Isabel, coming into the drawing room at Garden Court, coming in from a wet walk or whatever, that rainy afternoon, finds Madame Merle in possession of the place, Madame Merle seated, all absorbed but all serene, at the piano, and deeply recognizes, in the striking of such an hour, in the presence there, among the gathering shades, of this personage, of whom a moment before she had never so much as heard, a turning point in her life. It is dreadful to have too much, for any artistic demonstration, to dot one's I's and insist on one's intentions, and I am not eager to do it now, but the question here was that of producing the maximum of intensity with the minimum of strain. The interest was to be raised to its pitch and yet the elements to be kept in their key, so that, should the whole thing duly impress, I might show what an exciting inward life may do for the person leading it even while it remains perfectly normal. And I cannot think of a more consistent application of that ideal unless it be in the long statement, just beyond the middle of the book, of my young woman's extraordinary meditative vigil on the occasion that was to become for her such a landmark. Reduced to its essence, it is but the vigil of searching criticism, but it throws the action further forward than 20 incidents might have done. It was designed to have all the vivacity of incidents and all the economy of picture. She sits up, by her dying fire, far into the night, under the spell of recognitions on which she finds the last sharpness suddenly wait. It is a representation simply of her motionlessly seeing, and an attempt withal to make the mere still lucidity of her act as interesting as the surprise of a caravan or the identification of a pirate. It represents, for that matter, one of the identifications dear to the novelist, and even indispensable to him, but it all goes on without her being approached by another person and without her leaving her chair. It is obviously the best thing in the book, but it is only a supreme illustration of the general plan. As to Henrietta, my apology for whom I just left incomplete, she exemplifies, I fear, in her superabundance, not an element of my plan, but only an excess of my zeal. So early was to begin my tendency to overtreat, rather than undertreat, when there was choice or danger, my subject. Many members of my craft, I gather, are far from agreeing with me, but I have always held overtreating the minor disservice, treating that of the portrait amounted to never forgetting, by any lapse, that the thing was under a special obligation to be amusing. There was the danger of the noted thinness which was to be averted, tooth and nail, by cultivation of the lively. That is at least how I see it today. Henrietta must have been at that time a part of my wonderful notion of the lively. And then there was another matter. I had, within the few preceding years, come to live in London, and the international light lay, in those days, to my sense, thick and rich upon the scene. It was the light in which so much of the picture hung. But that is another matter. There is a really too much to say. Henry James, A. The Portrait of a Lady, A. Chapter 1. Under certain circumstances there are few hours in life more agreeable than the hour dedicated to the ceremony known as afternoon tea. There are circumstances in which, whether you partake of the tea or not, some people of course never do, the situation is in itself delightful. Those that I have in mind in beginning to unfold this simple history offered an admirable setting to an innocent pastime. The implements of the little feast had been disposed upon the lawn of an old English country house, in what I should call the perfect middle of a splendid summer afternoon. Part of the afternoon had waned, but much of it was left, and what was left was of the finest and rarest quality. Real dusk would not arrive for many hours, but the flood of summer light had begun to ebb, the air had grown mellow, the shadows were long upon the smooth, dense turf. They lengthened slowly, however, and the scene expressed that sense of leisure still to come which is perhaps the chief source of one's enjoyment of such a scene at such an hour. From 5 o'clock to 8 is on certain occasions a little eternity, but on such an occasion as this the interval could be only an eternity of pleasure. The persons concerned in it were taking their pleasure quietly, and they were not of the sex which is supposed to furnish the regular votaries of the ceremony I have mentioned. The shadows on the perfect lawn were straight and angular. They were the shadows of an old man sitting in a deep wicker chair near the low table on which the tea had been served, and of two younger men strolling to and fro, in desultory talk, in front of him. The old man had his cup in his hand. It was an unusually large cup, of a different pattern from the rest of the set and painted in brilliant colors. He disposed of its contents with much circumspection, holding it for a long time close to his chin, with his face turned to the house. His companions had either finished their tea or were indifferent to their privilege. They smoked cigarettes as they continued to stroll. One of them, from time to time, as he passed, looked with a certain attention at the elder man, who, unconscious of observation, rested his eyes upon the rich red front of his dwelling. The house that rose beyond the lawn was a structure to repay such consideration and was the most characteristic object in the peculiarly English picture I have attempted to sketch. It stood upon a low hill, above the river being the Thames at some 40 miles from London. A long gabled front of red brick, with the complexion of which time and the weather had played all sorts of pictorial tricks, only, however, to improve and refine it, presented to the lawn its patches of ivy, its clustered chimneys, its windows smothered in creepers. The house had a name and a history. The old gentleman taking his tea would have been delighted to tell you these things, how it had been built under Edward VI, had offered a knight's hospitality to the great Elizabeth, whose august person had extended itself upon a huge, magnificent and terribly angular bed which still formed the principal honor of the sleeping apartments, had been a good deal bruised and defaced in Cromwell's wars, and then, under the Restoration, repaired and much enlarged, and how, finally, after having been remodeled and disfigured in the 18th century, it had passed into the careful keeping of a shrewd American banker, who had bought it originally because, owing to circumstances too complicated to set forth, it was offered at a great bargain, bought it with much grumbling at its ugliness, its antiquity, its incommodity, and who now, at the end of 20 years, had become conscious of a real aesthetic passion for it, so that he knew all its points and would tell you just where to stand to see them in combination and just the hour when the shadows of its various protuberances which fell so softly upon the warm, weary brickwork, were of the right measure. Besides this, as I have said, he could have counted off most of the successive owners and occupants, several of whom were known to general fame, doing so, however, with an undemonstrative conviction that the latest phase of its destiny was not the least honorable. The front of the house overlooking that portion of the lawn with which we are concerned was not the entrance front, this was in quite another quarter. Privacy here reigned supreme, and the wide carpet of turf that covered the level hilltop seemed but the extension of a luxurious interior. The great still oaks and beeches flung down a shade as dense as that of velvet curtains, and the place was furnished, like a room, with cushioned seats, with rich colored rugs, with the books and papers that lay upon the grass. The river was at some distance, where the ground began to slope the lawn, properly speaking, ceased. But it was nonetheless a charming walk down to the water. The old gentleman at the tea table, who had come from America 30 years before, had brought with him, at the top of his baggage, his American physiognomy, and he had not only brought it with him, but he had kept it in the best order, so that, if necessary, he might have taken it back to his own country with perfect confidence. At present, obviously, nevertheless, he was not likely to displace himself. His journeys were over and he was taking the rest that precedes the great rest. He had a narrow, clean-shaven face, with features evenly distributed and an expression of placid acuteness. It was evidently a face in which the range of representation was not large, so that the air of contented shrewdness was all the more of a merit. It seemed to tell that he had been successful in life, yet it seemed to tell also that his success had not been exclusive and invidious, but had had much of the inoffensiveness of failure. He had certainly had a great experience of men, but there was an almost rustic simplicity in the faint smile that played upon his lean, spacious cheek and lighted up his humorous eye as he at last slowly and carefully deposited his big teacup upon the table. He was neatly dressed, in well-brushed black, but a shawl was folded upon his knees, and his feet were encased in thick, embroidered slippers. A beautiful collie dog lay upon the grass near his chair, watching the master's face almost as tenderly as the master took in the still more magisterial physiognomy of the house, and a little bristling, bustling terrier bestowed a desultory attendance upon the other gentleman. One of these was a remarkably well-made man of 35, with a face as English as that of the old gentleman I have just sketched with something else, a noticeably handsome face, fresh-colored, fair and frank, with firm, straight features, a lively gray eye and the rich adornment of a chestnut beard. This person had a certain fortunate, brilliant exceptional look, the air of a happy temperament fertilized by a high civilization, which would have made almost any observer envy him at a venture. He was booted and spurred, as if he had dismounted from a long ride, he wore a white hat, which looked too large for him, he held his two hands behind him, and in one of them, a large, white, well-shaped fist, was crumpled a pair of soiled dogskin gloves. His companion, measuring the length of the lawn beside him, was a person of quite a different pattern, who, although he might have excited grave curiosity, would not, like the other, have provoked you to wish yourself, almost blindly, in his place. Tall, lean, loosely and feebly put together, he had an ugly, sickly, witty, charming face, furnished, but by no means decorated, with a straggling mustache and whisker. He looked clever and ill, a combination by no means felicitous, and he wore a brown velvet jacket. He carried his hands in his pockets, and there was something in the way he did it that showed the habit was inveterate. His gait had a shambling, wandering quality. He was not very firm on his legs. As I have said, whenever he passed the old man in the chair he rested his eyes upon him, and at this moment, with their faces brought into relation, you would easily have seen they were father and son. The father caught his son's eye at last and gave him a mild, responsive smile. "I'm getting on very well," he said. "Have you drunk your tea?" asked the son. "Yes, and enjoyed it. Shall I give you some more?" The old man considered, placidly. "Well, I guess I'll wait and see." He had, in speaking, the American tone. "Are you cold?" the son inquired. The father slowly rubbed his legs. "Well, I don't know. I can't tell till I feel." "Perhaps someone might feel for you," said the younger man, laughing. "Oh, I hope someone will always feel for me. Don't you feel for me, Lord Warburton?" "Oh yes, immensely," said the gentleman addressed as Lord Warburton, promptly. "I'm bound to say you look wonderfully comfortable." "Well, I suppose I am, in most respects." And the old man looked down at his green shawl and smoothed it over his knees. "The fact is I've been comfortable so many years that I suppose I've got so used to it I don't know it." "Yes, that's the bore of comfort," said Lord Warburton. "We only know when we're uncomfortable." "It strikes me we're rather particular," his companion remarked. "Oh yes, there's no doubt we're particular," Lord Warburton murmured. And then the three men remained silent a while, the two younger ones standing looking down at the other, who presently asked for more tea. "I should think you would be very unhappy with that shawl," Lord Warburton resumed while his companion filled the old man's cup again. "Oh no, he must have the shawl," cried the gentleman in the velvet coat. "Don't put such ideas as that into his head." "It belongs to my wife," said the old man simply. "Oh, if it's for sentimental reasons," and Lord Warburton made a gesture of apology. "I suppose I must give it to her when she comes," the old man went on. "You'll please to do nothing of the kind. You'll keep it to cover your poor old legs." "Well, you mustn't abuse my legs," said the old man. "I guess they are as good as yours." "Oh, you're perfectly free to abuse mine," his son replied, giving him his tea. "Well, we're two lame ducks, I don't think there's much difference. I'm much obliged to you for calling me a duck. How's your tea?" "Well, it's rather hot." "That's intended to be a merit." "Ah, there's a great deal of merit," murmured the old man, kindly. "He's a very good nurse, Lord Warburton."
"Isn't he a bit clumsy?" asked his lordship.
"Oh no, he's not clumsy, considering that he's an invalid himself. He's a very good nurse, for a sick nurse. I call him my sick nurse because he's sick himself."
"Oh, come, Daddy!" the ugly young man exclaimed.
"Well, you are, I wish you weren't. But I suppose you can't help it."
"I might try, that's an idea," said the young man.
"Were you ever sick, Lord Warburton?" his father asked. Lord Warburton considered a moment.
"Yes, sir, once, in the Persian Gulf."
"He's making light of you, Daddy," said the other young man. "That's a sort of joke."
"Well, there seem to be so many sorts now," Daddy replied, serenely. "You don't look as if you had been sick, anyway, Lord Warburton."
"He's sick of life, he was just telling me so, going on fearfully about it," said Lord Warburton's friend.
"Is that true, sir?" asked the old man gravely.
"If it is, your son gave me no consolation. He's a wretched fellow to talk to, a regular cynic. He doesn't seem to believe in anything."
"That's another sort of joke," said the person accused of cynicism.
"It's because his health is so poor," his father explained to Lord Warburton. "It affects his mind and colors his way of looking at things. He seems to feel as if he had never had a chance. But it's almost entirely theoretical, you know, it doesn't seem to affect his spirits. I've hardly ever seen him when he wasn't cheerful, about as he is at present. He often cheers me up."
The young man so described looked at Lord Warburton and laughed. "Is it a glowing eulogy or an accusation of levity? Should you like me to carry out my theories, Daddy?"
"By Jove, we should see some queer things," cried Lord Warburton.
"I hope you haven't taken up that sort of tone," said the old man.
"Warburton's tone is worse than mine, he pretends to be bored. I'm not in the least bored, I find life only too interesting."
"Ah, too interesting, you shouldn't allow it to be that, you know.
I'm never bored when I come here," said Lord Warburton. "One gets such uncommonly good talk."
"Is that another sort of joke?" asked the old man. You've no excuse for being bored anywhere. When I was your age I had never heard of such a thing. You must have developed very late.
No, I developed very quick, that was just the reason. When I was 20 years old I was very highly developed indeed. I was working tooth and nail.
You wouldn't be bored if you had something to do, but all you young men are too idle. You think too much of your pleasure. You're too fastidious, and too indolent, and too rich.
Oh, I say, cried Lord Warburton, you're hardly the person to accuse a fellow creature of being too rich.
Do you mean because I'm a banker? Asked the old man.
Because of that, if you like, and because you have, haven't you? Such unlimited means.
He isn't very rich, the other young man mercifully pleaded. He has given away an immense deal of money.
Well, I suppose it was his own, said Lord Warburton, and in that case could there be a better proof of wealth? Let not a public benefactor talk of one's being too fond of pleasure.
Dad is very fond of pleasure, of other people's.
The old man shook his head. I don't pretend to have contributed anything to the amusement of my contemporaries.
My dear father, you're too modest.
That's a kind of joke, sir, said Lord Warburton.
You young men have too many jokes. When there are no jokes you've nothing left.
Fortunately there are always more jokes, the ugly young man remarked.
I don't believe it, I believe things are getting more serious.
You young men will find that out.
The increasing seriousness of things, then that's the great opportunity of jokes.
They'll have to be grim jokes, said the old man. I'm convinced there will be great changes, and not all for the better.
I quite agree with you, sir, Lord Warburton declared. I'm very sure there will be great changes, and that all sorts of queer things will happen. That's why I find so much difficulty in applying your advice. You know, you told me the other day that I ought to take hold of something. One hesitates to take hold of a thing that may the next moment be knocked sky high.
You ought to take hold of a pretty woman, said his companion. He's trying hard to fall in love, he added, by way of explanation, to his father.
The pretty women themselves may be sent flying, Lord Warburton exclaimed.
No. No, they'll be firm, the old man rejoined, they'll not be affected by the social and political changes I just referred to.
You mean they won't be abolished?
Very well, then, I'll lay hands on one as soon as possible and tie her round my neck as a life preserver.
The ladies will save us, said the old man, that is the best of them will, for I make a difference between them. Make up to a good one and marry her, and your life will become much more interesting. A momentary silence marked perhaps on the part of his auditors a sense of the magnanimity of this speech, for it was a secret neither for his son nor for his visitor that his own experiment in matrimony had not been a happy one. As he said, however, he made a difference, and these words may have been intended as a confession of personal error, though of course it was not in place for either of his companions to remark that apparently the lady of his choice had not been one of the best.
If I marry an interesting woman I shall be interested, is that what you say?
Lord Warburton asked. I'm not at all keen about marrying, your son misrepresented me, but there's no knowing what an interesting woman might do with me.
I should like to see your idea of an interesting woman, said his friend.
My dear fellow, you can't see ideas, especially such highly ethereal ones as mine. If I could only see it myself, that would be a great step in advance.
Well, you may fall in love with whomsoever you please, but you mustn't fall in love with my niece, said the old man.
His son broke into a laugh. He'll think you mean that as a provocation.
My dear father, you've lived with the English for 30 years, and you've picked up a good many of the things they say. But you've never learned the things they don't say.
I say what I please, the old man returned with all his serenity.
I haven't the honor of knowing your niece, Lord Warburton said. I think it's the first time I've heard of her.
She's a niece of my wife's, Mrs. Touchett brings her to England.
Then young Mr. Touchett explained.
My mother, you know, has been spending the winter in America, and we're expecting her back. She writes that she has discovered a niece and that she has invited her to come out with her.
I see, very kind of her, said Lord Warburton. Is the young lady interesting?
We hardly know more about her than you, my mother has not gone into details. She chiefly communicates with us by means of telegrams, and her telegrams are rather inscrutable. They say women don't know how to write them, but my mother has thoroughly mastered the art of condensation.
Tired America, hot weather awful, return England with niece, first steamer decent cabin. That's the sort of message we get from her, that was the last that came. But there had been another before, which I think contained the first mention of the niece. Changed hotel, very bad, impudent clerk, address here. Taken sister's girl,
died last year, go to Europe, two sisters, quite independent. Over that my father and I have scarcely stopped puzzling, it seems to admit of so many interpretations.
There's one thing very clear in it, said the old man, she has given the hotel clerk a dressing.
I'm not sure even of that, since he has driven her from the field. We thought at first that the sister mentioned might be the sister of the clerk, but the subsequent mention of a niece seems to prove that the allusion is to one of my aunts. Then there was a question as to whose the two other sisters were. They are probably two of my late aunt's daughters.
But who's quite independent, and in what sense is the term used?
That point's not yet settled.
Does the expression apply more particularly to the young lady my mother has adopted, or does it characterize her sisters equally? And is it used in a moral or in a financial sense? Does it mean that they've been left well off, or that they wish to be under no obligations? Or does it simply mean that they're fond of their own way?
Whatever else it means, it's pretty sure to mean that, Mr. Touchett remarked.
You'll see for yourself, said Lord Warburton. When does Mrs. Touchett arrive?
We're quite in the dark, as soon as she can find a decent cabin. She may be waiting for it yet, on the other hand she may already have disembarked in England.
In that case she would probably have telegraphed to you.
She never telegraphs when you would expect it, only when you don't, said the old man. She likes to drop on me suddenly, she thinks she'll find me doing something wrong. She has never done so yet, but she's not discouraged.
It's her share in the family trait, the independence she speaks of. Her son's appreciation of the matter was more favorable. Whatever the high spirit of those young ladies may be, her own is a match for it. She likes to do everything for herself and has no belief in anyone's power to help her. She thinks me of no more use than a postage stamp without gum, and she would never forgive me if I should presume to go to Liverpool to meet her.
Will you at least let me know when your cousin arrives? Lord Warburton asked.
Only on the condition I've mentioned, that you don't fall in love with her. Mr. Touchett replied.
That strikes me as hard, don't you think me good enough?
I think you too good, because I shouldn't like her to marry you. She hasn't come here to look for a husband, I hope, so many young ladies are doing that, as if there were no good ones at home. Then she's probably engaged, American girls are usually engaged, I believe. Moreover I'm not sure, after all, that you'd be a remarkable husband.
Very likely she's engaged, I've known a good many American girls, and they always were, but I could never see that it made any difference, upon my word.
As for my being a good husband, Mr. Touchett's visitor pursued, I'm not sure of that either. One can but try.
Try as much as you please, but don't try on my niece, smiled the old man, whose opposition to the idea was broadly humorous.
Ah, well, said Lord Warburton with a humor broader still, perhaps, after all, she's not worth trying on, eh?
Chapter 2. While this exchange of pleasantries took place between the two, Ralph Touchett wandered away a little, with his usual slouching gait, his hands in his pockets and his little rowdy-ish terrier at his heels. His face was turned toward the house, but his eyes were bent musingly on the lawn, so that he had been an object of observation to a person who had just made her appearance in the ample doorway for some moments before he perceived her. His attention was called to her by the conduct of his dog, who had suddenly darted forward with a little volley of shrill barks, in which the note of welcome, however, was more sensible than that of defiance. The person in question was a young lady, who seemed immediately to interpret the greeting of the small beast. He advanced with great rapidity and stood at her feet, looking up and barking hard, whereupon, without hesitation, she stooped and caught him in her hands, holding him face to face while he continued his quick chatter. His master now had time to follow and to see that Bunchy's new friend was a tall girl in a black dress, who at first sight looked pretty. She was bareheaded, as if she were staying in the house, a fact which conveyed perplexity to the son of its master, conscious of that immunity from visitors which had for some time been rendered necessary by the latter's ill health. Meantime the two other gentlemen had also taken note of the newcomer.
"Dear me, who's that strange woman?" Mr. Touchett had asked.
"Perhaps it's Mrs. Touchett's niece, the independent young lady," Lord Warburton suggested. "I think she must be, from the way she handles the dog."
The collie, too, had now allowed his attention to be diverted, and he trotted toward the young lady in the doorway, slowly setting his tail in motion as he went.
"But where is my wife then?" murmured the old man.
"I suppose the young lady has left her somewhere, that's a part of the independence."
The girl spoke to Ralph, smiling, while she still held up the terrier.
"Is this your little dog, sir?"
"He was mine a moment ago, but you've suddenly acquired a remarkable air of property in him."
"Couldn't we share him?" asked the girl. "He's such a perfect little darling."
Ralph looked at her a moment. She was unexpectedly pretty. "You may have him altogether," he then replied. The young lady seemed to have a great deal of confidence, both in herself and in others, but this abrupt generosity made her blush. "I ought to tell you that I'm probably your cousin," she brought out, putting down the dog. "And here is another," she added quickly, as the collie came up. "Probably?" the young man exclaimed, laughing. "I supposed it was quite settled. Have you arrived with my mother?"
"Yes, half an hour ago."
"And has she deposited you and departed again?"
"No, she went straight to her room, and she told me that, if I should see you, I was to say to you that you must come to her there at 7:15.
The young man looked at his watch. "Thank you very much, I shall be punctual." And then he looked at his cousin. "You're very welcome here. I'm delighted to see you." She was looking at everything, with an eye that denoted clear perception, at her companion, at the two dogs, at the two gentlemen under the trees, at the beautiful scene that surrounded her. "I've never seen anything so lovely as this place. I've been all over the house, it's too enchanting."
"I'm sorry you should have been here so long without our knowing it. Your mother told me that in England people arrived very quietly, so I thought it was all right. Is one of those gentlemen your father?"
"Yes, the elder one, the one sitting down," said Ralph. The girl gave a laugh. "I don't suppose it's the other."
"Who's the other?"
"He's a friend of ours, Lord Warburton."
"Oh, I hoped there would be a lord, it's just like a novel. And then, oh you adorable creature!" she suddenly cried, stooping down and picking up the small dog again. She remained standing where they had met, making no offer to advance or to speak to Mr. Touchett, and while she lingered so near the threshold, slim and charming, her interlocutor wondered if she expected the old man to come and pay her his respects. American girls were used to a great deal of deference, and it had been intimated that this one had a high spirit. Indeed, Ralph could see that in her face. "Won't you come and make acquaintance with my father?" he nevertheless ventured to ask. "He's old and infirm, he doesn't leave his chair."
"Ah, poor man, I'm very sorry," the girl exclaimed, immediately moving forward. "I got the impression from your mother that he was rather intensely active." Ralph Touchett was silent a moment. "She hasn't seen him for a year. Well, he has a lovely place to sit. Come along, little hound."
"It's a dear old place," said the young man, looking sidewise at his neighbor.
"What's his name?"
she asked, her attention having again reverted to the terrier.
"My father's name?"
"Yes," said the young lady with amusement, "but don't tell him I asked you." They had come by this time to where old Mr. Touchett was sitting, and he slowly got up from his chair to introduce himself.
"My mother has arrived," said Ralph, "and this is Miss Archer." The old man placed his two hands on her shoulders, looked at her a moment with extreme benevolence and then gallantly kissed her. "It's a great pleasure to me to see you here, but I wish you had given us a chance to receive you."
"Oh, we were received," said the girl. "There were about a dozen servants in the hall. And there was an old woman curtsying at the gate.
We can do better than that, if we have notice." And the old man stood there smiling, rubbing his hands and slowly shaking his head at her. "But Mrs. Touchett doesn't like receptions." She went straight to her room.
"Yes, and locked herself in. She always does that. Well, I suppose I shall see her next week." And Mrs. Touchett's husband slowly resumed his former posture.
"Before that," said Miss Archer, "she's coming down to dinner, at 8:00. Don't you forget 7:15, she added, turning with a smile to Ralph.
"What's to happen at 7:15?
"I'm to see my mother," said Ralph.
"Ah, happy boy," the old man commented.
"You must sit down, you must have some tea," he observed to his wife's niece.
"They gave me some tea in my room the moment I got there," this young lady answered.
"I'm sorry you're out of health," she added, resting her eyes upon her venerable host.
"Oh, I'm an old man, my dear, it's time for me to be old. But I shall be the better for having you here."
She had been looking all round her again. At the lawn, the great trees, the reedy, silvery Thames, the beautiful old house, and while engaged in this survey she had made room in it for her companions, a comprehensiveness of observation easily conceivable on the part of a young woman who was evidently both intelligent and excited. She had seated herself and had put away the little dog, her white hands, in her lap, were folded upon her black dress, her head was erect, her eye lighted, her flexible figure turned itself easily this way and that, in sympathy with the alertness with which she evidently caught impressions. Her impressions were numerous, and they were all reflected in a clear, still smile. "I've never seen anything so beautiful as this.
It's looking very well, said Mr. Touchett. I know the way it strikes you. I've been through all that. But you're very beautiful yourself, he added with a politeness by no means crudely jocular and with the happy consciousness that his advanced age gave him the privilege of saying such things, even to young persons who might possibly take alarm at them. What degree of alarm this young person took need not be exactly measured. She instantly rose, however, with a blush which was not a refutation. Oh yes, of course I'm lovely. She returned with a quick laugh. How old is your house? Is it Elizabethan? It's early Tudor, said Ralph Touchett. She turned toward him, watching his face. Early Tudor? How very delightful. And I suppose there are a great many others. There are many much better ones. Don't say that, my son. The old man protested. There's nothing better than this. I've got a very good one, I think in some respects it's rather better, said Lord Warburton, who as yet had not spoken, but who had kept an attentive eye upon Miss Archer. He slightly inclined himself, smiling. He had an excellent manner with women. The girl appreciated it in an instant, she had not forgotten that this was Lord Warburton. I should like very much to show it to you, he added. Don't believe him, cried the old man, don't look at it. It's a wretched old barrack, not to be compared with this. I don't know, I can't judge, said the girl, smiling at Lord Warburton. In this discussion Ralph Touchett took no interest whatever. He stood with his hands in his pockets, looking greatly as if he should like to renew his conversation with his newfound cousin. Are you very fond of dogs? He inquired by way of beginning. He seemed to recognize that it was an awkward beginning for a clever man. Very fond of them indeed. You must keep the terrier, you know, he went on, still awkwardly. I'll keep him while I'm here, with pleasure. That will be for a long time, I hope. You're very kind. I hardly know. My aunt must settle that. I'll settle it with her, at 7:15. And Ralph looked at his watch again. I'm glad to be here at all, said the girl. I don't believe you allow things to be settled for you. Oh yes, if they're settled as I like them. I shall settle this as I like it, said Ralph. It's most unaccountable that we should never have known you. I was there, you had only to come and see me. There? Where do you mean? In the United States, in New York and Albany and other American places. I've been there, all over, but I never saw you. I can't make it out. Miss Archer just hesitated. It was because there had been some disagreement between your mother and my father, after my mother's death, which took place when I was a child. In consequence of it we never expected to see you. Ah, but I don't embrace all my mother's quarrels, heaven forbid. The young man cried. You've lately lost your father? He went on more gravely. Yes. More than a year ago. After that my aunt was very kind to me, she came to see me and proposed that I should come with her to Europe. I see, said Ralph. She has adopted you. Adopted me? The girl stared, and her blush came back to her, together with a momentary look of pain which gave her interlocutor some alarm. He had underestimated the effect of his words. Lord Warburton, who appeared constantly desirous of a near review of Miss Archer, strolled toward the two cousins at the moment. And as he did so she rested her wider eyes on him. Oh no, she has not adopted me. I'm not a candidate for adoption. I beg 1,000 pardons, Ralph murmured. I meant, he hardly knew what he meant. You meant she has taken me up? Yes, she likes to take people up. She has been very kind to me, but, she added with a certain visible eagerness of desire to be explicit, I'm very fond of my liberty. Are you talking about Mrs. Touchett? The old man called out from his chair. Come here, my dear, and tell me about her. I'm always thankful for information. The girl hesitated again, smiling. She's really very benevolent, she answered, after which she went over to her uncle, whose mirth was excited by her words. Lord Warburton was left standing with Ralph Touchett, to whom in a moment he said, You wished a while ago to see my idea of an interesting woman. There it is, eh? Chapter 3. Mrs. Touchett was certainly a person of many oddities, of which her behavior on returning to her husband's house after many months was a noticeable specimen. She had her own way of doing all that she did, and this is the simplest description of a character which, although by no means without liberal motions, rarely succeeded in giving an impression of suavity. Mrs. Touchett might do a great deal of good, but she never pleased. This way of her own, of which she was so fond, was not intrinsically offensive, it was just unmistakably distinguished from the ways of others. The edges of her conduct were so very clear-cut that for susceptible persons it sometimes had a knife-like effect.
that hard fineness came out in her deportment during the first hours of her return from America, under circumstances in which it might have seemed that her first act would have been to exchange greetings with her husband and son. Mrs. Touchett, for reasons which she deemed excellent, always retired on such occasions into impenetrable seclusion, postponing the more sentimental ceremony until she had repaired the disorder of dress with a completeness which had the less reason to be of high importance, as neither beauty nor vanity were concerned in it. She was a plain-faced old woman, without graces and without any great elegance, but with an extreme respect for her own motives. She was usually prepared to explain these, when the explanation was asked as a favor, and in such a case they proved totally different from those that had been attributed to her. She was virtually separated from her husband, but she appeared to perceive nothing irregular in the situation. It had become clear, at an early stage of their community, that they should never desire the same thing at the same moment, and this appearance had prompted her to rescue disagreement from the vulgar realm of accident. She did what she could to erect it into a law, a much more edifying aspect of it, by going to live in Florence, where she bought a house and established herself, and by leaving her husband to take care of the English branch of his bank. This arrangement greatly pleased her, it was so felicitously definite. It struck her husband in the same light, in a foggy square in London, where it was at times the most definite fact he discerned, but he would have preferred that such unnatural things should have a greater vagueness. To agree to disagree had cost him an effort, he was ready to agree to almost anything but that, and saw no reason why either assent or dissent should be so terribly consistent. Mrs. Touchett indulged in no regrets nor speculations, and usually came once a year to spend a month with her husband, a period during which she apparently took pains to convince him that she had adopted the right system. She was not fond of the English style of life, and had three or four reasons for it to which she currently alluded. They bore upon minor points of that ancient order, but for Mrs. Touchett they amply justified non-residence. She detested bread sauce, which, as she said, looked like a poultice and tasted like soap. She objected to the consumption of beer by her maidservants, and she affirmed that the British laundress, Mrs. Touchett, was very particular about the appearance of her linen, was not a mistress of her art. At fixed intervals she paid a visit to her own country, but this last had been longer than any of its predecessors. She had taken up her niece, there was little doubt of that. One wet afternoon, some 4 months earlier than the occurrence lately narrated, this young lady had been seated alone with a book. To say she was so occupied is to say that her solitude did not press upon her, for her love of knowledge had a fertilizing quality and her imagination was strong. There was at this time, however, a want of fresh taste in her situation which the arrival of an unexpected visitor did much to correct. The visitor had not been announced, the girl heard her at last walking about the adjoining room. It was in an old house at Albany, a large, square, double house, with a notice of sale in the windows of one of the lower apartments. There were two entrances, one of which had long been out of use but had never been removed. They were exactly alike, large white doors, with an arched frame and wide sidelights, perched upon little stoops of red stone, which descended sidewise to the brick pavement of the street. The two houses together formed a single dwelling, the party wall having been removed and the rooms placed in communication. These rooms, above stairs, were extremely numerous, and were painted all over exactly alike, in a yellowish white which had grown sallow with time. On the third floor there was a sort of arched passage, connecting the two sides of the house, which Isabel and her sisters used in their childhood to call the tunnel, and which, though it was short and well lighted, always seemed to the girl to be strange and lonely, especially on winter afternoons. She had been in the house, at different periods, as a child, in those days her grandmother lived there. Then there had been an absence of 10 years, followed by a return to Albany before her father's death. Her grandmother, old Mrs. Archer, had exercised, chiefly within the limits of the family, a large hospitality in the early period, and the little girls often spent weeks under her roof, weeks of which Isabel had the happiest memory. The manner of life was different from that of her own home, larger, more plentiful, practically more festal. The discipline of the nursery was delightfully vague, and the opportunity of listening to the conversation of one's elders, which with Isabel was a highly valued pleasure, almost unbounded. There was a constant coming and going. Her grandmother's sons and daughters and their children appeared to be in the enjoyment of standing invitations to arrive and remain, so that the house offered to a certain extent the appearance of a bustling provincial inn kept by a gentle old landlady who sighed a great deal and never presented a bill. Isabel, of course, knew nothing about bills, but even as a child she thought her grandmother's home romantic. There was a covered piazza behind it, furnished with a swing which was a source of tremulous interest, and beyond this was a long garden, sloping down to the stable and containing peach trees of barely credible familiarity. Isabel had stayed with her grandmother at various seasons, but somehow all her visits had a flavor of peaches.
On the other side, across the street, was an old house that was called the Dutch House, a peculiar structure dating from the earliest colonial time, composed of bricks that had been painted yellow, crowned with a gable that was pointed out to strangers, defended by a rickety wooden paling and standing sidewise to the street. It was occupied by a primary school for children of both sexes, kept or rather let go, by a demonstrative lady of whom Isabel's chief recollection was that her hair was fastened with strange bedroomy combs at the temples and that she was the widow of someone of consequence. The little girl had been offered the opportunity of laying a foundation of knowledge in this establishment, but having spent a single day in it, she had protested against its laws and had been allowed to stay at home, where, in the September days, when the windows of the Dutch house were open, she used to hear the hum of childish voices repeating the multiplication table, an incident in which the elation of liberty and the pain of exclusion were indistinguishably mingled. The foundation of her knowledge was really laid in the idleness of her grandmother's house, where, as most of the other inmates were not reading people, she had uncontrolled use of a library full of books with frontispieces, which she used to climb upon a chair to take down. When she had found one to her taste, she was guided in the selection chiefly by the frontispiece. She carried it into a mysterious apartment which lay beyond the library and which was called, traditionally, no one knew why, the office. Whose office it had been and at what period it had flourished, she never learned. It was enough for her that it contained an echo and a pleasant musty smell and that it was a chamber of disgrace for old pieces of furniture whose infirmities were not always apparent, so that the disgrace seemed unmerited and rendered them victims of injustice, and with which, in the manner of children, she had established relations almost human, certainly dramatic. There was an old haircloth sofa in especial, to which she had confided 100 childish sorrows. The place owed much of its mysterious melancholy to the fact that it was properly entered from the second door of the house, the door that had been condemned, and that it was secured by bolts which a particularly slender little girl found it impossible to slide. She knew that this silent, motionless portal opened into the street. If the side lights had not been filled with green paper, she might have looked out upon the little brown stoop and the well-worn brick pavement. But she had no wish to look out, for this would have interfered with her theory that there was a strange, unseen place on the other side, a place which became to the child's imagination, according to its different moods, a region of delight or of terror. It was in the office still that Isabel was sitting on that melancholy afternoon of early spring which I have just mentioned. At this time she might have had the whole house to choose from, and the room she had selected was the most depressed of its scenes. She had never opened the bolted door nor removed the green paper, renewed by other hands, from its sidelights. She had never assured herself that the vulgar street lay beyond. A crude, cold rain fell heavily. The springtime was indeed an appeal, and it seemed a cynical, insincere appeal, to patience. Isabel, however, gave as little heed as possible to cosmic treacheries. She kept her eyes on her book and tried to fix her mind. It had lately occurred to her that her mind was a good deal of a vagabond, and she had spent much ingenuity in training it to a military step and teaching it to advance, to halt, to retreat, to perform even more complicated maneuvers, at the word of command. Just now she had given it marching orders and it had been trudging over the sandy plains of a history of German thought. Suddenly she became aware of a step very different from her own intellectual pace. She listened a little and perceived that someone was moving in the library, which communicated with the office. It struck her first as the step of a person from whom she was looking for a visit, then almost immediately announced itself as the tread of a woman and a stranger, her possible visitor being neither. It had an inquisitive, experimental quality which suggested that it would not stop short of the threshold of the office, and in fact the doorway of this apartment was presently occupied by a lady who paused there and looked very hard at our heroine. She was a plain, elderly woman, dressed in a comprehensive waterproof mantle. She had a face with a good deal of rather violent point. "Oh," she began, "is that where you usually sit?" She looked about at the heterogeneous chairs and tables. "Not when I have visitors," said Isabel, getting up to receive the intruder. She directed their course back to the library while the visitor continued to look about her. "You seem to have plenty of other rooms, they're in rather better condition. But everything's immensely worn." "Have you come to look at the house?" Isabel asked. "The servant will show it to you." "Send her away, I don't want to buy it. She has probably gone to look for you and is wandering about upstairs, she didn't seem at all intelligent. You had better tell her it's no matter." And then, since the girl stood there hesitating and wondering, this unexpected critic said to her abruptly, "I suppose you're one of the daughters?" Isabel thought she had very strange manners. "It depends upon whose daughters you mean." "The late Mr. Archer's, and my poor sister's." "Ah," said Isabel slowly, "you must be our crazy Aunt Lydia. Is that what your father told you to call me?"
I'm your Aunt Lydia, but I'm not at all crazy, I haven't a delusion.
And which of the daughters are you?
I'm the youngest of the three, and my name's Isabel.
Yes, the others are Lillian and Edith.
And are you the prettiest?
I haven't the least idea, said the girl.
I think you must be.
And in this way the aunt and the niece made friends.
The aunt had quarreled years before with her brother-in-law, after the death of her sister, taking him to task for the manner in which he brought up his three girls. Being a high-tempered man, he had requested her to mind her own business, and she had taken him at his word. For many years she held no communication with him, and after his death had addressed not a word to his daughters, who had been bred in that disrespectful view of her which we have just seen Isabel betray.
Mrs. Touchett's behavior was, as usual, perfectly deliberate. She intended to go to America to look after her investments, with which her husband, in spite of his great financial position, had nothing to do, and would take advantage of this opportunity to inquire into the condition of her nieces. There was no need of writing, for she should attach no importance to any account of them she should elicit by letter, she believed, always, in seeing for oneself. Isabel found, however, that she knew a good deal about them, and knew about the marriage of the two elder girls, knew that their poor father had left very little money, but that the house in Albany, which had passed into his hands, was to be sold for their benefit, knew, finally, that Edmund Ludlow, Lillian's husband, had taken upon himself to attend to this matter, in consideration of which the young couple, who had come to Albany during Mr. Archer's illness, were remaining there for the present and, as well as Isabel herself, occupying the old place.
How much money do you expect for it? Mrs. Touchett asked of her companion, who had brought her to sit in the front parlor, which she had inspected without enthusiasm.
I haven't the least idea, said the girl.
That's the second time you have said that to me, her aunt rejoined. And yet you don't look at all stupid.
I'm not stupid, but I don't know anything about money.
Yes, that's the way you were brought up, as if you were to inherit a million.
What have you in point of fact inherited?
I really can't tell you. You must ask Edmund and Lillian, they'll be back in half an hour.
In Florence we should call it a very bad house, said Mrs. Touchett, but here, I dare say, it will bring a high price.
It ought to make a considerable sum for each of you. In addition to that you must have something else, it's most extraordinary your not knowing. The position's of value, and they'll probably pull it down and make a row of shops. I wonder you don't do that yourself, you might let the shops to great advantage.
Isabel stared, the idea of letting shops was new to her.
I hope they won't pull it down, she said, I'm extremely fond of it.
I don't see what makes you fond of it, your father died here.
Yes, but I don't dislike it for that, the girl rather strangely returned. I like places in which things have happened, even if they're sad things. A great many people have died here, the place has been full of life.
Is that what you call being full of life?
I mean full of experience, of people's feelings and sorrows. And not of their sorrows only, for I've been very happy here as a child.
You should go to Florence if you like houses in which things have happened, especially deaths. I live in an old palace in which three people have been murdered, three that were known and I don't know how many more besides.
In an old palace? Isabel repeated.
Yes, my dear, a very different affair from this. This is very bourgeois.
Isabel felt some emotion, for she had always thought highly of her grandmother's house. But the emotion was of a kind which led her to say, I should like very much to go to Florence.
Well, if you'll be very good, and do everything I tell you I'll take you there, Mrs. Touchett declared.
Our young woman's emotion deepened, she flushed a little and smiled at her aunt in silence.
Do everything you tell me? I don't think I can promise that.
No, you don't look like a person of that sort. You're fond of your own way, but it's not for me to blame you.
And yet, to go to Florence, the girl exclaimed in a moment, I'd promise almost anything.
Edmund and Lillian were slow to return, and Mrs. Touchett had an hour's uninterrupted talk with her niece, who found her a strange and interesting figure, a figure essentially, almost the first she had ever met. She was as eccentric as Isabel had always supposed, and hitherto, whenever the girl had heard people described as eccentric, she had thought of them as offensive or alarming. The term had always suggested to her something grotesque and even sinister. But her aunt made it a matter of high but easy irony, or comedy, and led her to ask herself if the common tone, which was all she had known, had ever been as interesting. No one certainly had on any occasion so held her as this little thin-lipped, bright-eyed, foreign-looking woman, who retrieved an insignificant appearance by a distinguished manner and, sitting there in a well-worn waterproof, talked with striking familiarity of the courts of Europe. There was nothing flighty about Mrs. Touchett, but she recognized no social superiors,
and, judging the great ones of the earth in a way that spoke of this, enjoyed the consciousness of making an impression on a candid and susceptible mind. Isabel at first had answered a good many questions, and it was from her answers apparently that Mrs. Touchett derived a high opinion of her intelligence. But after this she had asked a good many, and her aunt's answers, whatever turn they took, struck her as food for deep reflection. Mrs. Touchett waited for the return of her other niece as long as she thought reasonable, but as at 6 o'clock Mrs. Ludlow had not come and she prepared to take her departure. "Your sister must be a great gossip. Is she accustomed to staying out so many hours?" "You've been out almost as long as she," Isabel replied. "She can have left the house but a short time before you came in." Mrs. Touchett looked at the girl without resentment. She appeared to enjoy a bold retort and to be disposed to be gracious. "Perhaps she hasn't had so good an excuse as I tell her at any rate that she must come and see me this evening at that horrid hotel. She may bring her husband if she likes, but she needn't bring you. I shall see plenty of you later, eh?" Chapter 4. Mrs. Ludlow was the eldest of the three sisters, and was usually thought the most sensible, the classification being in general that Lillian was the practical one, Edith the beauty and Isabel the intellectual superior. Mrs. Keyes, the second of the group, was the wife of an officer of the United States Engineers, and as our history is not further concerned with her it will suffice that she was indeed very pretty and that she formed the ornament of those various military stations, chiefly in the unfashionable West, to which, to her deep chagrin, her husband was successively relegated. Lillian had married a New York lawyer, a young man with a loud voice and an enthusiasm for his profession. The match was not brilliant, any more than Edith's, but Lillian had occasionally been spoken of as a young woman who might be thankful to marry at all. She was so much plainer than her sisters. She was, however, very happy, and now, as the mother of two peremptory little boys and the mistress of a wedge of brownstone violently driven into 53rd Street, seemed to exult in her condition as in a bold escape. She was short and solid, and her claim to figure was questioned, but she was conceded presence, though not majesty. She had moreover, as people said, improved since her marriage, and the two things in life of which she was most distinctly conscious were her husband's force in argument and her sister Isabel's originality. "I've never kept up with Isabel, it would have taken all my time," she had often remarked, in spite of which, however, she held her rather wistfully in sight, watching her as a motherly spaniel might watch a free greyhound. "I want to see her safely married, that's what I want to see," she frequently noted to her husband. "Well, I must say I should have no particular desire to marry her," Edmund Ludlow was accustomed to answer in an extremely audible tone. "I know you say that for argument, you always take the opposite ground. I don't see what you've against her except that she's so original." "Well, I don't like originals, I like translations," Mr. Ludlow had more than once replied. "Isabel's written in a foreign tongue. I can't make her out. She ought to marry an Armenian or a Portuguese." "That's just what I'm afraid she'll do," cried Lillian, who thought Isabel capable of anything. She listened with great interest to the girl's account of Mrs. Touchett's appearance and in the evening prepared to comply with their aunt's commands. Of what Isabel then said no report has remained, but her sister's words had doubtless prompted a word spoken to her husband as the two were making ready for their visit. "I do hope immensely she'll do something handsome for Isabel, she has evidently taken a great fancy to her." "What is it you wish her to do?" Edmund Ludlow asked. "Make her a big present?" "No indeed, nothing of the sort. But take an interest in her, sympathize with her. She's evidently just the sort of person to appreciate her. She has lived so much in foreign society, she told Isabel all about it. You know you've always thought Isabel rather foreign. You want her to give her a little foreign sympathy, eh? Don't you think she gets enough at home?" "Well, she ought to go abroad," said Mrs. Ludlow. "She's just the person to go abroad." "And you want the old lady to take her, is that it?" "She has offered to take her, she's dying to have Isabel go. But what I want her to do when she gets her there is to give her all the advantages. I'm sure all we've got to do," said Mrs. Ludlow, "is to give her a chance."
"A chance for what?"
"A chance to develop."
"Oh Moses!" Edmund Ludlow exclaimed. "I hope she isn't going to develop anymore."
"If I were not sure you only said that for argument I should feel very badly," his wife replied. "But you know you love her."
"Do you know I love you?" the young man said, jocosely, to Isabel a little later, while he brushed his hat.
"I'm sure I don't care whether you do or not," exclaimed the girl, whose voice and smile, however, were less haughty than her words.
"Oh, she feels so grand since Mrs. Touchett's visit," said her sister.
But Isabel challenged this assertion with a good deal of seriousness. "You must not say that, Lily. I don't feel grand at all."
I'm sure there's no harm, said the conciliatory Lily.
Ah, but there's nothing in Mrs. Touchett's visit to make one feel grand.
Oh, exclaimed Ludlow, she's grander than ever.
Whenever I feel grand, said the girl, it will be for a better reason.
Whether she felt grand or no, she at any rate felt different, as if something had happened to her. Left to herself for the evening, she sat a while under the lamp, her hands empty, her usual avocations unheeded. Then she rose and moved about the room, and from one room to another, preferring the places where the vague lamplight expired. She was restless and even agitated, at moments she trembled a little. The importance of what had happened was out of proportion to its appearance. There had really been a change in her life. What it would bring with it was as yet extremely indefinite, but Isabel was in a situation that gave a value to any change. She had a desire to leave the past behind her and, as she said to herself, to begin afresh. This desire indeed was not a birth of the present occasion, it was as familiar as the sound of the rain upon the window, and it had led to her beginning afresh a great many times. She closed her eyes as she sat in one of the dusky corners of the quiet parlor, but it was not with a desire for dozing forgetfulness. It was on the contrary because she felt too wide-eyed and wished to check the sense of seeing too many things at once. Her imagination was by habit ridiculously active. When the door was not open, it jumped out of the window. She was not accustomed indeed to keep it behind bolts, and at important moments, when she would have been thankful to make use of her judgment alone, she paid the penalty of having given undue encouragement to the faculty of seeing without judging. At present, with her sense that the note of change had been struck, came gradually a host of images of the things she was leaving behind her. The years and hours of her life came back to her, and for a long time, in a stillness broken only by the ticking of the big bronze clock, she passed them in review. It had been a very happy life, and she had been a very fortunate person. This was the truth that seemed to emerge most vividly. She had had the best of everything, and in a world in which the circumstances of so many people made them unenviable, it was an advantage never to have known anything particularly unpleasant. It appeared to Isabel that the unpleasant had been even too absent from her knowledge, for she had gathered from her acquaintance with literature that it was often a source of interest and even of instruction. Her father had kept it away from her, her handsome, much-loved father, who always had such an aversion to it. It was a great felicity to have been his daughter. Isabel rose even to pride in her parentage. Since his death she had seemed to see him as turning his braver side to his children and as not having managed to ignore the ugly quite so much in practice as in aspiration. But this only made her tenderness for him greater. It was scarcely even painful to have to suppose him too generous, too good-natured, too indifferent to sordid considerations. Many persons had held that he carried this indifference too far, especially the large number of those to whom he owed money. Of their opinions Isabel was never very definitely informed, but it may interest the reader to know that, while they had recognized in the late Mr. Archer a remarkably handsome head and a very taking manner, indeed, as one of them had said, he was always taking something, they had declared that he was making a very poor use of his life. He had squandered a substantial fortune, he had been deplorably convivial, he was known to have gambled freely. A few very harsh critics went so far as to say that he had not even brought up his daughters. They had had no regular education and no permanent home, they had been at once spoiled and neglected, they had lived with nursemaids and governesses, usually very bad ones, or had been sent to superficial schools, kept by the French, from which, at the end of a month, they had been removed in tears. This view of the matter would have excited Isabel's indignation, for to her own sense her opportunities had been large. Even when her father had left his daughters for 3 months at Neufchâtel with a French bonne who had eloped with a Russian nobleman staying at the same hotel, even in this irregular situation, an incident of the girl's 11th year, she had been neither frightened nor ashamed, but had thought it a romantic episode in a liberal education. Her father had a large way of looking at life, of which his restlessness and even his occasional incoherency of conduct had been only a proof. He wished his daughters, even as children, to see as much of the world as possible. And it was for this purpose that, before Isabel was 14, he had transported them 3 times across the Atlantic, giving them on each occasion, however, but a few months' view of the subject proposed, a course which had whetted our heroine's curiosity without enabling her to satisfy it. She ought to have been a partisan of her father, for she was the member of his trio who most made up to him for the disagreeables he didn't mention. In his last days, his general willingness to take leave of a world in which the difficulty of doing as one liked appeared to increase as one grew older had been sensibly modified.